people that are hired, the goods and services that are purchased, all help the Anchorage economy grow and prosper.
The mayor of Anchorage formally supports Alaska Native Corporation 8A business. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 23rd of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, developing new ways to replenish crab stocks.
Over the last 3 years, we were able to develop technology to raise large numbers of juvenile king crab.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. If you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-7848. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
Anchorage needs to take a more active role helping Alaska Native corporations keep their 8A business development program. That was the message of Mayor Dan Sullivan and Alaska Congressman Don Young at a press conference yesterday at Anchorage's City Hall. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Provisions within the Small Business Administration's 8A program allow Alaska Native profit corporations special contract provisions on certain federal projects. In recent years, under this arrangement, several regional and village corporations have showed impressive revenue gains. According to Alaska Business Monthly's latest list of state-based corporations, in 2008, the top five were all Native corporations, with the first three each posting revenues of over $1 billion. Of the first 10, eight are Native corporations. The total revenues for the 12 Native corporations making the magazine's list was nearly $10 billion. The corporations are a key component of the state's economic health, and, says Mayor Sullivan, they have a huge impact on Anchorage's economic well-being.
From a selfish standpoint, as mayor of Anchorage, we have many of the Native corporation headquarters here. These are business entities that are literally producing hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in revenue. That revenue comes back to the state of Alaska, and the people that are hired, the goods and services that are purchased, all help the Anchorage economy grow and prosper.
But for over a year, the special provisions for Alaska Native corporations have come under attack in Congress. Some critics question their fairness. Others have doubted how much the program has actually boosted Alaska Native hire and provided shareholder benefits. Last week, the Anchorage Assembly passed a resolution proposed by the mayor in support of 8A. Sullivan says he intends to take Anchorage's 8A concerns to a national gathering.
I'm going to the Conference of Mayors in January. I'm going to carry the resolution that the Assembly passed. I want the Conference of Mayors to weigh in on this as well.
Alaska Native corporations employ nearly 13,000 state residents, and with their various subsidiaries, nearly 55,000 total employees throughout the nation and worldwide. Congressman Young says the program should not fall victim to its success.
I think the system has worked. I know it's ironic to me that people attack this. This is one successful program. Why should they attack it? They should say hallelujah, because most of the programs that have come out of the government, including the BIA programs, have not worked. This has worked, so I'm a big supporter, and I'll continue to support it.
Sullivan added many smaller Native corporations, especially village and private companies, are still trying to take advantage of the 8A program. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
While a recent report from the Department of Natural Resources shows about 10 years of natural gas is available in Cook Inlet, there remains the difficulty of delivering gas on peak use days, especially in cold winter weather when customers are using more gas to heat their homes and businesses. Two state lawmakers have announced their plans to introduce legislation aimed at addressing deliverability and a possible long-term decline in gas production. KDLL's Ben Stanton reports.
The Cook Inlet Recovery Act is the effort of House Speaker Mike Chenault of Nikiski and Representative Mike Hawker of Anchorage. Chenault says that in light of the recent DNR study, there needs to be a way to get current deposits of gas to market. He says that the declining production of natural gas in South Central Alaska has hurt the local economy, and now the possibility of a shortage is a threat to safety.
Naturally, we've came up with some ideas. We'll see whether they work with the industry and certainly see whether we can get the support to pass them and try to make sure that that we don't get into a situation where we don't have the gas to keep consumers and businesses heated.
While the bill has not been made final, one part of the language will center on incentives for building natural gas storage facilities through tax breaks and streamlining payments of tax credits already in place. Chenault says there are several companies looking at building storage facilities in the area. One such company is Cook Inlet Natural Gas LLC, recently formed by TransCanada. That company's executives have been meeting with city and borough administration to discuss several possible locations in the city of Kenai for a storage facility. However, Chenault says that company and others with interest in gas storage have not asked for changes. Instead, the legislators have approached companies to have a dialogue about the situation and the business environment for the industry.
And, they have questions concerning RCA control and different issues there. So, as we work our way through it, we'll see what works for not only the state of Alaska, but what would work to ensure that if we need in-ground storage, that we have the ability to move forward with that and not be hampered by it.
Another part of the bill would be eliminating a tax on companies that do business on the North Slope and Cook Inlet. Chenault says the tax credits in place now cannot be transferred between operations in the two locations.
It may make it better for them to make the investment here in Cook Inlet because of the gas issue versus making that same investment up on the North Slope. Might be a disincentive for them to invest in the Cook Inlet when they may be able to get a better tax break on that same money invested in Prudhoe Bay.
Chenault says if this bill becomes law, it would be only one component of a larger effort to address Cook Inlet gas issues. He says this bill addresses short-term gas needs, and he says legislators and the public will need to look longer term, up to 50 years in the future, to understand what may come.
More than likely that there won't be another big gas find here in the Cook Inlet. It'll all be smaller fields, but we know the consumer base is going to probably continue to grow. So when we start talking about other components, we may be talking about, hydro projects or certainly a bullet line or a spur line to the Cook Inlet to relieve the gas issue here.
Chenault has also said he does not feel this proposed legislation would hurt any chances of a bullet line coming to fruition. He says he and Hawker have worked on the bill since the summertime. It may need more work before likely getting pre-filed in early January before the legislature convenes January 19th. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
An Alaska Native corporation is taking a new look at an old technology in an effort to wrest unused power from an untapped source. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Cook Inlet Region Incorporated is hoping to stabilize fluctuating supplies and prices by taking an alternative look at an old fossil fuel. Siri wants to try out an unusual method of turning coal into power. It's called underground coal gasification, and Siri is eyeing coal deposits deep under the land the corporation owns northwest of Beluga to test the plan. The corporation has applied to the state for permission to drill 6 exploratory wells on the west side of Cook Inlet to find out if conditions are right for a UCG project. Ethan Schutt is vice president of Siri Land and Energy Development.
You inject an oxidant-like air down to the deeply buried coal seam. You start a combustion reaction, and that combustion reaction creates heat and pressure. And the heat and pressure drive the rest of the chemical reactions that gasify the coal and release its energy.
The result is syngas, or synthesis gas, which is primarily hydrogen, carbon monoxide, and carbon dioxide.
And then you produce that gas stream up to the surface through a second well or series of wells and make your use of it.
There is no subsurface or strip mining involved. Instead, the entire conversion process occurs 650 feet underground below the freshwater aquifer. The UCG technology uses heat and pressure to break coal down into its chemical elements, hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon, and into a simpler chemical form, a gas stream of hydrogen, carbon monoxide, and carbon dioxide.
at that point you do have a usable product. You can take exactly that, scrub out some of the impurities, and burn it through a natural gas turbine and generate electricity. So in that state and with that project goal, you never have a liquid.
The resulting syngas is a feeder fuel that can be converted into a variety of products, jet fuel, LNG, or residential energy. The gas would be piped out of the facility to a planned power plant near Beluga.
You can upgrade that syngas stream through other chemical reactions into liquid fuels for synthetic diesel, synthetic gasoline that you can use in your cars or trucks, synthetic aviation fuel that you can use in airplanes.
The fact that the entire process takes place in an underground chamber limits pollution and waste and emits no CO2 into the atmosphere. The CO2 is captured and locked underground during the process. Similar coal-to-gas projects are set for Wyoming and North Dakota. Schutt says although the technology is complicated, Lawrence Livermore Laboratory is on board as a SERI consultant. SERI is budgeting $30 million of its own money for the project. If tests are positive and future plans successful, a UCG facility could provide 100 megawatts for Rail Belt energy needs in future, according to SERI spokesman Jim Jaeger.
Assuming everything's successful and we progress to where we're making either synthetic natural gas or liquid fuels, that's when you have a product that you can export outside of the region to supply either rural Alaska or export it outside to, you know, replace liquid fuels down along the West Coast.
Jaeger says the UCG project could be online as early as 2014. SERI is following an aggressive schedule with core sampling set for February if drill permits come through next January. Schutt says the exploration area has generally suitable characteristics and drilling core samples will enable SERI to select specific sites for development. SERI is a new player in the energy market and the UCG plan could expand SERI's role as an energy producer. The project mines energy without actually mining the coal. And if the technology is proven, coal could bump oil off its throne. The State Department of Natural Resources has set a December 31st deadline for public comment on the drill site's permit. As of this week, State Senators Liesl McGuire and Bill Willikowski have announced plans to introduce a package of state incentives aimed at spurring alternative energy options for Alaska. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, reviving a sled dog race in Eniac.
I love training out here more than anything. You don't have the hustle and bustle of the city.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
Residents in Eniac are reviving the Eniac 150 sled dog race. The race was a competitive event until about 5 years ago when organizers couldn't pull it together anymore. Now, thanks to young leaders in town, the race is making a comeback and inspiring new mushers to get into the sport. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
Roxanne Longpre is a champion fundraiser. Give her a cause and the 30-year-old will sell baked goods, raffle off bigger prizes, and is skilled at asking for donations. Last year, local musher Dave Deal asked her to help raise money to revive the Eniac 150. Longpre didn't hesitate to help, but she didn't have much time to pull in funds before the March race.
So within 10 weeks, I was able to rally up enough money with raffles, donations, tickets from the airlines, almost $11,000. And then, that was a huge chunk of money that we had to play with. And we actually had six teams, three from Eniac and three from Bethel.
The race went from Eniac to Georgetown, up the Kuskokwim River. Musher Dave Deal is excited to have a homegrown race again. He watched the original Eniac 150 fizzle out from lack of support.
It just kind of went to the wayside. Nobody picked up the ball until last year.
Deal is a retired school teacher who works nights in his wife Esther's pizza and burger takeout joint. The Hound House is the only restaurant in town and has no shortage of customers. As Deal assembles cheeseburgers, he explains why it's important to have a local race.
With the intention of trying to have competitive races up here for our dog team so they can go into the other villages and, you know, I did a, you know, maybe eventually I did a rod and have race experience.
Dave Deal says his competitive racing days are over, but he's helping his son get started in the sport. Out behind the Hound House, 30 dogs are yelping in appreciation of their evening meal. Deal's son, Richie Deal, just finished feeding them. He's the racer in the house these days, with a crop of young lead dogs from Jeff King's and Aaron Burmeister's kennels.
I got Tater over here. He's my main guy. He's only three, and he does the brunt of the leading. Then I got three others over there. I got Roger.
Deal says maintaining Davis, a dog team so far off the road system has its challenges and rewards, too.
I mean, it's just, you look at guys who operate kennels out of, like, Big Lake and Wasilla, all they got to do is drive down the road to, you know, the local feed store and buy $40 sack of dog food for $40. Well, that $40 sack of dog food out here costs $58 after all the shipping and stuff. So it's a hassle, but I love training out here more than anything. You don't have the hustle and bustle of the city, and so I like training around here.
The race has inspired a few more mushers in Antioch to prepare for the Antioch 150 this season. Roxanne Longpre says it's been fun to watch the event take off again.
Within a year, we've had three more teams come to Antioch or decide they want to race, which is great. That means it's actually putting some spirit back into dog mushing here in Antioch.
Longpre isn't a musher herself, but she looks at the race as a way to bring the town together. She grew up in Antioch and remembers big community-wide events that have largely faded away over the years. The race start in March was inspiring for Roxanne and her husband, Jacques.
That was the cool thing. The whole town was down there when the race went out, and people were there greeting the mushers as they came in. There was a fire with hot dogs provided by the race. It was beautiful.
The second annual revived Antioch 150 is scheduled to take place the last week of February. The organizers hope it may one day be an Iditarod qualifier. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
With an eye toward the possibility of someday rebuilding depleted stocks, scientists are continuing to study how to raise larval king crab in a hatchery setting. From KMXT in Kodiak, Diana Gish has more.
The Alaska King Crab Research, Rehabilitation, and Biology Program, or ACCRAB, is a cooperative project through the Alaska Sea Grant Program. Several groups are taking part in the crab-rearing project. The goal of the program is to conduct research aimed at hatching and rearing red and blue king crab at a large-scale hatchery. One of the members of the research team is Ben Daly at the Seward Marine Center. He's one of two scientists who's carrying out the larval rearing of the crabs at the shellfish hatchery.
So right now, we're about to enter our fourth year of hatchery experiments, and over the last 3 years, we were able to develop technology to raise large numbers of juvenile king crab. And so that was a big milestone for the project, just developing that technology. So the next question then becomes, how would a hatchery crab survive in the wild after it's released?
In the next few years, the researchers hope to carry out more ecologically based research, both in the lab and in the field.
How would a hatchery juvenile compete with a wild juvenile crab in the wild? You know, we don't want to raise crabs that are going to go out and outcompete the wild ones or anything like that. And we want to make sure they would survive. You know, you don't want to pour all this money into a hatchery that produces crabs that would just basically get eaten or starve to death in the wild.
To get to this point, Daly and his partner worked for 3 years to learn how to raise the crabs from eggs to juveniles.
We're really proud of the progress we made. They're extremely hard to rear, and not very many places in the world are able to do it. They're extremely slow growers. So just maintaining adequate hatchery conditions over, you know, it's like a 50-day period that they're larvae. So maintaining adequate hatchery conditions just alone for that long of a period is a challenge in itself.
With the challenge came both frustrations and breakthroughs.
So that first year, we had really poor success. Basically, all the larvae died towards the end of the larval rearing stage. And that was extremely frustrating because, you know, it was this 50-day long rearing period that you're really working your tail off this whole time. And then all your animals die at the last minute. And it was pretty tough. This past year, we had a great success. We were able to produce 100,000 juvenile red king crab, which was kind of like a milestone to us. It was a really big number that we were able to achieve.
In addition to the hatching studies, National Marine Fisheries scientists in Kodiak are conducting studies on the dietary needs of larval and juvenile king crab. I'm Diana Gish.
Southeast's Dungeness crab catch topped 3.5 million pounds this past year. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game tallied harvest records from four summer and fall months. Adam Messmer is the department's shellfish management assistant biologist.
This fall, we had 949,000 pounds. And for this previous summer, we had 2.6 million pounds for a total of a little over 3.5 million pounds.
This year's catch is down from 4.7 million pounds landed last year. The organized village of Kasan has submitted a proposal to the Board of Fish seeking to close the District 2 fishery in the summer, saying this year's reopening of that area impacted subsistence harvest of crab. The board will consider that proposal at its meeting in March. The average Dungeness crab price for both the summer and fall season was $1.72 a pound, with a total fishery value of $5.9 million. One area of Southeast near Sitka remains open through the end of February.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991. On the web at akbudgetreport.com. Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at reddogalaska.com. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business.
The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is getting a boost in funding for the Dental Health Aid Therapy, or DHAT, program, $2 million of a $3 million appropriation within the Federal Omnibus Appropriations Act for 2010 will go to support training more dental aid therapists for rural Alaska. Dr. Mary Willard is the program's director. She says the funding is a first.
All of our funding in the past has been grant funding, so this is the first appropriations we've gotten for this program.
Willard says the program started at ANTHC in 2007. Before ANTHC started its own dental health aid therapy program, students were sent to New Zealand for training. Willard says there are currently 10 therapists working in rural Alaska communities that otherwise would not have someone who can teach oral hygiene and perform cleaning, filling, and extractions. She says there are 14 more students in training.
What we've seen is people are really receptive, and the communities are very happy to have their therapists there. They want to come see them. They request to see the therapist when they come in for services. So that's great.
Willard says the money will be used to create billing infrastructure for long-term sustainability. The next generation of state ferries is one step closer to reality, and it's a big step. Federal officials have approved up to $60 million for the project. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports from Juneau.
The Alaska Marine Highway System wants to build several new ferries to cover some shorter runs. The ships are being designed to handle Lynn Canal, Prince Rupert to Ketchikan, and some other inside waters routes in southeast Alaska and Prince William Sound. The best cost estimate for the first ship is $120 million. Lawmakers have already put aside half that amount. Now the federal government has committed to a matching figure. Jim Beadle is the state's deputy commissioner for marine transportation.
The feds are okay with the project.
They're okay with what we have set up for the funding. Now we need to request for permission from the legislature to spend the $60 million that's in the Alaska Marine Highway Fund on this project.
Governor Parnell's recently released capital budget did not include any state money for the new ferry. That concerned Marine Transportation Advisory Board Chairman Mike Korsmo, but he says federal funding is just fine.
When I first saw the budget come out, I was like, oh. You know, that not thinking about you know, whether we're going to pay for it with state funding, federal funding, you know, just to make sure that we had enough money to get the project off the ground.
When state lawmakers set aside money for a new ship several years ago, it wasn't this ship, what officials are calling the Alaska-class ferry. That's why the legislature will be asked for final approval this session. It will take a budget amendment to appropriate the needed state money. Parnell's budget director, Karen Rehfeld, says she expects that to happen after a meeting in January. The federal funds are coming through the statewide transportation improvement program, known as the STIP. Recent approval of Alaska's STIP list effectively okayed money for dozens of projects, including the Alaska-class ferry. That doesn't always guarantee full, immediate funding, but Jeff Otteson of the State Transportation Department says the money should come through.
Our money is coming to us in 2010 in kind of the installment plan. If I project those numbers out and assume Congress doesn't change their mind sometime going forward, we have enough money in the STIP to cover the $60 million for the ferry.
Seattle's Elliott Bay Design Group has already come up with preliminary plans for the new ferry. They've been presented to the public, and a final design is expected around the end of February. Ferry officials say the new ships will allow an older vessel to be retired, but mainliners, which travel longer routes, will not be completely phased out of the system. In Juneau, this is Ed Schoenfeld.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Diana Gish in Kodiak, Ben Stanton in Kenai, and Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Annie Fight reported from ENIAC. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Communication Systems, keeping Alaska connected with solutions for small businesses that manage your company's voice and data systems so you can focus on running your business. ACSAlaska.com.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at FNBAlaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Help manage subsistence hunting and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The deadline to apply is January the 8th. For more information, call 800-478-1456. This announcement is sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Subsistence Management.
Regional Council Lanun Una Nampakka Lagalugu. 800-478-1456. Application not humchikut January 8th dami. Unakankigun khtuk U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Office of Subsistence Management, Anchorage, Jamuk.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.